Vakasha, I don't know how many more weeks we have on Rav Shmuel Moliver.
I think three, this and
three
two
weeks.
more, I believe.
Okay.
And I'll just start that Mel is always a medakdek, and he says it's Hanates, not Nates. You pointed it out before. And by the way, if I ever get back to my class on my book on Halachic History of America, I've been way late because I'm really into the Besamim Rosh now. I have like 90 pages. That might be a little book, but I will show you that Shabbos used to start and end earlier. People listening can remember Shabbos used to be earlier. It there's no question that it used to end earlier. And I don't remember if it was started earlier, but it definitely used to end earlier. We never, growing up, never ended Shabbos like 9:27 in New Jersey. And I thought it was just something I remembered, maybe incorrectly, but I actually have the show bulletins. So I have to determine when the change happened, like in the mid-80s or something, that Shabbos started ending later. I don't think it began later. I think
right.
It's only ended later. That's
it's
it
the same thing.
The same
it's
time.
Everywhere. Dr. Mark, it's the same thing. When I was a kid, Shabbos ended 42, 1 hour after Lech Benching. Whenever Lech Benching was, an hour later, Shabbos is over. Today it's like an hour and 7 minutes later.
Okay, so it's interesting. So I'm going to try to figure out actually where this came from. You know, if you look in your local shuls, you go on their websites, when the Zmanim are, each shul gets the Zmanim from somewhere else. And we know on our trips, I use Chabad and also my Zmanim. And sometimes there's conflicts between them. So it's an interesting thing. But no need to develop that anymore at the moment. I want to thank you all for being here. This is class number 5 on Rav Moliver. It's December 9th, 2024. First, let me say, I saw a number of Torah Motion listeners yesterday at the Tikva conference. In fact, my wife was working there, and she had to be there 6 a.m., so we had to leave the house like 5:10 a.m. Believe it or not, Lincoln Square has a Sunday morning minyan at 7 a.m., and Moshe Sokolow, the Torah Motion teacher, who many of you probably know, was there. We got to the door at the same time, so I was very impressed, 7 o'clock. Not only did I see some people there who we know, Rabbi Dov and others, but people who just listened to us. So you know who you are. Thank you very much. I see Ruth, you're with us. Good, because I have the answer to your question. Let me first begin. A number of things I want to get to. I got the copy of the book from my university library. The first dictionary of Yiddish. I think to buy it, it's like $50. So it's not worth buying it, but I highly recommend checking it out. It's alphabetical with all the words, and he shows the origin of it and how they're used. And then, of course, at the beginning, he has examples. So, for example, the Pledge of Allegiance in English and in Yeshivish, the Gettysburg Address, Anthony's eulogy from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. So here, the Pledge of Allegiance. Instead of I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic which it stands, etc., I am meshabed myself, Bli Neder, to hold stark to the simon of the United States of America and to the Medina, which is Gufa Itztachlis, one festa chevra, Bezras Hashem, Echad V'yochid, with Simcha and Erechid for the Gansa Oilam. So that's with liberty and justice for all. I don't know, Simcha is not really liberty, but I would say Chayrus. But so that's interesting, I think. Look, it's a real thing, Yeshivish. I try not to speak Yeshivish. I use Hebrew. Now, that might be hard for some people, but I use Hebrew. But there's a difference between using Hebrew and speaking Yeshivish. I sometimes maybe fall into it, but I try not to. It's like I try not to say this. It's mashma from this text that's like Yeshivish. But to refer to a Hebrew term, that's what I'm going to do. Okay, now I have to... I was so interested in the clip from Reuven Feinstein that I actually listened to the entire tape. And it is true, for whatever reason, he didn't seem to have a lot of patience in that conversation, maybe because some of the questions were so really weird. And I really mean that. Some of the things that people ask, it's just I find it hard to believe that people have to ask it. But I'm going to show you now a clip, another 1 minute clip from him. And you, those of you who know Reuven, we have one of the family members, you can explain this to me, because first of all, We're going to only see two options here. One is that Reuven is completely clueless with what's going on in Israel, that he could say this, which I don't believe is the case. So therefore, you have to conclude that he's just so frustrated, and he's speaking, which I guess you would say, with his own intellect. And second, if you know what's going on in Israel with the army, how the owning the army for the Haredim is the absolute worst thing. And even in America, in certain yeshivas, when if students want to write letters to the people in the IDF, you know, the idea is, no, we can't have anything to do with that, because then they'll start idolizing the IDF, and that's a problem. So IDF is like, in Israel, is the absolute worst thing that you could do from a yeshiva student. So now I want you to listen to this. I do not see how Reuven Feinstein can at any way be regarded as part of the Haredi world after that. If they knew this, he has to be thrown out of it, because he is, it's like such betrayal from their mind for everything. So you got to listen to this. And it's, I find it amazing, actually. So let me share this with you. I think you hear his father maybe also in this, but listen to this. And he has to know what he's saying is like against the Das Torah in Israel. So listen to this. Oh, hold on. I gotta share with the sound. That's important. And I'm using my other computer now. So listen to this. Let me hold on. I want to make the sound up as high as I can. Okay.
Jim.
Yes.
Students are—they're brought up in the house and sometimes in school that they're proud to join the IDF. How do we do that?
So, Rashiva, the question was that his students are coming from homes where they're brought up to look up to the IDF and things like that, to join the IDF.
They want to join. They're 18 years old. Gesundheit, go. They'll probably turn you into a mensch.
Oh. They're sixth graders.
So obviously, so what difference does it make? You're not going to the army. So what are you, so I'm telling you, so I tell them, good, very good, keep it in my mind, you can do it. When you get to be 18, you go and enlist. Till then, you better study up, because you're not going to have any time after that to study. And therefore, you better study now. What's the problem?
So
what's wrong with it? They want to join the U.S. Army. Forget about the IDF. They want to join the U.S. Army. But it's not a shkait, so what are you talking about? So I'm telling them that you can do it, and I'll teach you something else meanwhile.
That's right. In the meantime,
why is there a problem? Why are you stuck with a question? The kid's not going, so what's the least that cup?
Next question.
So it's amazing. This is an issue that all these Haredi yeshivas, like one is worse than the other when it comes to the army. It's like the absolute worst thing. And I got to assume Reuven knows exactly what he's saying. That it's like, it's like, what? Go to the army, they'll turn you into a mensch. That is like kafira, literal kafira for the today, and unfortunately in the Haredi world in Israel. And it's amazing to hear him say that. And I guess he's not afraid that of what they're going to do to him. But that's the sort of thing that you literally would not be allowed to speak in any of the Haredi yeshivas in Israel. You'd be mechutz l'machaneh if you know what they're doing to this Rabbi David Label in Israel. So I don't know. I just wanted to share that with you. Not that it has anything to do with what we're doing. Okay. A couple other things before we begin. One of you, I think Shmuel, I think, if not, I apologize, sent me something that someone heard from Rav Gustman, that Rav Gustman reported that he saw the Chavetz Chaim, and the Chavetz Chaim didn't have tzitzis out. So he asked the Chavetz Chaim, why don't you have tzitzis out? You wrote it in the Mishnah Berurah. And the Chavetz Chaim answered that he's referring to people who, in general, their tzitzis are out, but when they see, let's say, non-Jews, they put it in. But he's not saying that you have to put the tzitzis out, ba'ofen kavua or anything like that, which is exactly the interpretation we saw before. Now, it's funny because the person who replies to this is on one of these websites. He says, I can't believe this is true because the Mishnah Berurah says otherwise, but this is what's reported. So that's that. I wonder if it would be very interesting to know what the Chavetz Chaim actually did himself. And in one of the comments on that, it's one of these online responsive things. Someone replies, but wait a second, we know that for the Zaks family, the son-in-law of the Chafetz Chaim didn't wear the tzitzis out. So why do you say it's not possible? I might have made a mistake. Well, you can judge this. I showed you last class the poster from the Machzikei Adas in London, in which they said that if you eat from the from the chief rabbinate, that if you eat from the shlita of the Machzikei Adas, well, they said the shlita is treif and you can't eat from it. So I suggested that when they say treif, it's a strong way of saying you're not allowed to eat it. But I find it hard to believe that if someone happened to buy it by mistake or had it and then cooked in it, that the keli would now be treif. Because after all, they're shochtim, they're reliable shochtim, shechting it. It's just that there's a takana from the community that you can't eat it. Moshe sends to me that maybe it's not so clear. He calls my attention to the Magid Mishnah in Hilchos Shrita, Parak 4, Halacha 4, that says there's a Yesh Omrim that if you violate, let's say, the rule of the community, then it's considered Nevela. Trace. Again, I don't know if that means after the fact, but you can find this in the Shulchan Aruch. And I invite everyone to look at it. It's in Hilchos Shlita, Yoredeya, Perek Aleph, plus Halacha, where are we? Halacha Yud Aleph, yes. It says as follows. If the Kiel has a Cherem that only their Shochet could Shech and someone else Shechs, Yesh Omrim Shechita So Asura. There are those that say that the Shechita is Asur. That is, you can't eat from it. Now, what's this language, Yesh Omrim? The Achronim dispute that. Does Yesh Omrim, some say, mean that the Shulchan Aruch holds this opinion? That's one view. Another view is that he doesn't hold of it. He's just putting it out there. And why does he say Yesh Omrim if he holds of it? So people explain, because it's not a widespread opinion. But if you look, to show you that it's as complicated, Moshe, just take a look, for instance, if you look in the Taz here, he says, what's the reason why it's, the Taz says that if someone checks without knowing about the Cherem, then it's not a problem. Okay, that's fine. But then if you look in the Pisrei Tshuva says, I don't see any discussion about the Kalim afterwards, but the Pisrei Tshuva says that, brings an opinion that if, despite this, if it's Hefsed Merubah, if you're going to lose a lot of money, that is, you brought like a bunch of meat to a shochet, and he's not the right shochet. Maybe you made a mistake, whatever. He says there is an opinion that you can eat it. If you look at the Gra, however, the Gra seems to be machmir. He said the Gra says, the Gra says if it's like he's a mumar, if the guy shechs without this, without the permission. So for that, he'd be no good. But if you look at the Machzik Sashekel, I see he quotes the Pri Chadas that says that this is only usher because he says Migdar Milsa. That is, the community is making a decree for policy reasons. De Medina Shlita So Muteris. Because according to Halacha, the Shlita is valid. So I think if that, according to the Pri Chadas, B'diavad, it would be okay. You can't, but if b'diavad, your kalim, if without knowing, for instance, if you cooked it in your kalim, I don't think it would be a problem. But you can see in the Nosei Kalim in the Shulchan Aruch, there's a dispute on this matter. Let's see, two more minutes. We spoke about, one more thing. If you look, Rabbi Greenwald, we spoke about him many times, Leopold Greenwald, his last sefer, published posthumously, is called Ashoke Bashlita, the Sifrut Terabbanit.
What is that?
Shlita.
Yeah.
Hold on. I gotta show up. Shlita and the Shoke in rabbinic literature. He doesn't discuss the Kalim also, but he, on page 94, he says, well, in general, if the community says only one Shoke could Shech, You have to know what the reason is. If it's to protect the parnasa of the shochet, then the shochet can then give permission for someone else. But if it's for general policy reasons, then he couldn't. We spoke about asking question of two different rabbis. And if you just Google in Hebrew, Sheila Achat L'Shnei Rabbanim, you see many discussions of it. Basically, there's a machokas on this thing because the Gemara already says that if you ask one rabbi and he says it's Tame, you can't ask another one to say it's Tahar. But the question is, why can't you? According to one opinion, it's because when one rabbi says, let's say it's treif, that creates a presumption of tarfus. So therefore it's treif. And then you couldn't ask it someone else. But another position is it's out of kavod for the first rabbi. So therefore, if you ask the second rabbi and you tell him that you already asked the other rabbi, then it's okay. In fact, Tosfos holds his position. The Ron holds his position. And if you recall last week, Rabbi Halperin said that he told Rabbi Shlomo Zalman that I asked Rabbi Yashiv. And Rabbi Shlomo Zalman is able then, as long as the new rabbi knows what the former rabbi said, it's not considered disrespectful because he now knows that Rabbi Yashiv thought differently and he can decide on his own what to do. Okay, that's enough for now. I want to, let's pick up right where we were. We are dealing with the Shemitah. Into some very interesting things today. The last thing question was Ruth asked about the issue of the dating. You know, so what's the problem? The problem is that when you calculate the Shemitah years and you have the Yovel on the 50th, so you go 7-7, you get to the 49th, then you have Yovel 50. What happens when you don't have the Beis HaMikdash and you calculate it? Do you then count? In other words, in 100 years, do you have 49 plus two extra years, or no? When you don't have, let's say, a Beis HaMikdash, do you then still do you forget the Yovel? So you go 7-7-7, and when you get to 49, you begin all over. It's interesting because the Rambam's position, the Rambam says what his position is, but then he says that you, let me get this right here. The Rambam says that we would still count, as I remember, the 50th year. That's what he thinks it should be, even if there's no Beis HaMikdash, but he says that the Gaonim thought differently, so we go by like the Gaonim. So, unless I have it backwards. But the point is, so there's a dispute. Then what is considered, what year are we? Which Shemitah year are we? So Ruth asked, does any discussions take this into account? I looked into it today, and I did not find any of the early discussions of the sabbatical year who raised this as a question that we're in doubt as to what the sabbatical year is. Perhaps I looked in this book, as well, other books as well, but this is a very good book that's not very well known. It's called The Jewish Dietary Laws by Dr. I. Grunfeld, famous translator of Hirsch's writings. The first volume is all about kashrus issues. Those people who learn Yaradeya, Nusing Tam Lifgam, and all those things that you learn when you learn for Smicha. But the second volume is all about the agricultural laws, and he has two large sections about Heter Mechira and Shemitah. So I looked there to see, like I said, as well as others, and he points out that the view, the opinion that we know when the Shemitah is. That is, any earlier disputes we're not concerned with anymore because there's been unanimous, basically, agreement. Therefore, we ignore the earlier opinion. And that, I see here he says that the Rambam original, his what he thinks the view is that even when we no longer have the Yovel, no Beis HaMikdash or anything, we still have to count the extra year between 49 and you add the 50. So that would be off 1 year. Even though he says halacha maisa, we're not going to do that. So that explains, even though everyone accepted the Gaonic position, why they didn't include this as a doubt. And no one says keep 2 years. However, Rav Kook does mention it, he says. Rav Kook says that there's a Safek Minyan Safek Atzumu. And Rav Kook includes this as one of his reasons for being lenient. And what Rabbi Grunfeld on page 192 says that He says that this can only be used, they only use the uncertainty of Shemitah year as one among many reasons in order to support its halachic validity. But as far as I could tell, none of the people who dealt with it before Rav Kook used this, and Rabbi Grunfeld doesn't mention it. Any people use that as well. So I can't find anyone else. I looked in Rav Avad Yosef has a very long responsa in the Abiya Omer, volume 10, all about the Heter Mechira, he supports it. And he mentioned, the first one he mentions to deal with, he calls it the Cheshbon, the calendar is Rav Kook. So I think Rav Kook is the first one really to take it seriously. And let me just add, this will be the last thing before we go forward. Two of you said that I misspoke, and maybe I did. In citing the opinion of Zerachia Halevi, the Balaam Or, this summer, God willing, we'll be in southern France. We're not going to be in Lunel, but we're going to drive right past it. We're not going to be in Lunel because there's nothing to see anymore. But we're going to pass right by it, go to another important place where there is things to see. But Lunel was a very, very important city of many Gedolim and major Jewish town, Jewish city. The Rambam wrote famous letters to the sages of Lunel. And while we pass it, I'll speak a lot about Rav Zerachia. He has some very unusual views. And I said last class that the whole, according to Rav Zerachia, the whole observance today of Shemitah is a minhag. Because he holds this, there's no halacha. So two of you commented, that I wasn't exact, because he doesn't say it's a minhag. He says it's midas chasidus. Now, midas chasidus is, Rabbi Grunfeld, he quotes the Balaam Or, he says midas chasidus, a pious custom. So I said it's a custom and, pious custom. But really, I probably was not exact in my language, because a custom means something, a minhag is that you have to do. We follow minhagim. It's not halacha, but we follow them. Rav Zerachia wasn't saying that it's a minhag, everyone does it, even though according to halacha we don't have to, we do it minhag. No, he wasn't saying that. He was saying it's midas chasidus, that it's like a pious thing to do. So I accept the criticism that I wasn't exact. What I meant to say was that us doing it today for Rav Zerachia would be regarded as the status of a minhag. Because technically he never said that from his standpoint in the medieval period. He's simply saying no one has to do it. If you want to do it, then you're being pious. So I thank you, for those, corrections. Okay, my friends, we ended last class, 1890, Rabbi Mulliver heads to Eretz Yisrael and he sees up close what's going on in the new yeshuvim. And that's where we're going to pick up right now. Now, we're going to talk about his views of Eretz Yisrael. We're going to see an interesting change in his perspective, a fascinating change. It becomes controversial. I just want to read you something before we go on from Rav Kook, because we have been so indoctrinated, I think, if you went to, let's say, B'nai Akiva, and I believe so, there's been indoctrination in a different form of Zionism than we're going to see. Let me just read you right at the beginning of Rav Kook's Orot. I'm reading you from B'tzalel Na'or's translation, the great B'tzalel Na'or. This is Rav Kook. This is the first paragraph or section in Orot. He says that the land of Israel is not an external national asset, a means to an end of collective solidarity. It's not about strengthening a nation's existence, physical or spiritual. He says it's an essential unit bound by the bond of life with the nation. He talks about how the depth of love for the land of Israel is not rational. He says that if you think of the land of Israel as instrumental, that it's to enforce the idea of the Jewish idea of the diaspora, to preserve Jewish identity, to strengthen faith, to strengthen awe of God, to strengthen observance of the mitzvos, none of these have permanent fruit, he says, because Eretz Yisrael was holy for its own sake. This is what Yeshaya Leibovitz used to call a form of idolatry. It's the idolatry of the land. But this is not what we're going to see with Rav Mulliver. And this really isn't what you see among most of the discussions before him. Yehuda Levi may be different, but it's all about Eretz Yisrael as a place where we can connect to God, where we have mitzvos, and it's the Jewish people, all that, but not the inherent special uniqueness of the land. The Judaism of the land of Israel, salvation itself. The holiness of the land of Israel, which needs to be recognized, not for what it can accomplish in your life, but for its essence in and of itself. It's an essentialist view. So Rav Moliver is not going to have that perspective. He goes to Israel and Eretz Yisrael, and he sends a letter. We have two letters from him from this period. One is actually after he returns. He sends a letter explaining what he saw. But before we get to that, I want to read you something else that actually from a couple of years before, before he went there, where he discusses, and this is before he goes to Eretz Yisrael, his perspective of what the land of Israel means. I've mentioned it a few times, certain things, but let me call your attention to a couple of things I haven't mentioned. In speaking about how important the land of Israel is, he says as follows. I don't know how well known this is or whether you can derive something differently from what he does, but he says, I'm going to bring you a proof from the Rambam how great the mitzvah of living in the land of Israel is. Now, remember, the Rambam doesn't even record living in the land of Israel as a positive commandment. It doesn't mean it's not important. I mean, if you look at all the commentaries on the Rambam, they say it's important to do mitzvahs, it's important for this or that, exactly the reasons that Rav Kook says you shouldn't focus on. But he says as follows, I'll even show it to you, because it's, see it with your own eyes here. By the way, here's Reuven again. Later in the, or earlier, I forget now, he's asked about wearing a hat. Some guy, I mean, again, these questions, a guy doesn't have his hat. So he wants to know, should he daven with the tzibur, because he doesn't have his hat with him, or should he go home and where he has his hat, then any davens be yechidus. And again, Rav Reuven, he doesn't understand the question. He's like, what are you talking about? He says, we have to daven with a minyan as a chiyuv. He said, a hat? He says, hats are only required when you used to go to the president wearing a hat. He says, today we don't do that, so you don't need a hat. He says, there's no need to. to wear a hat. And then he says, yes, so we have a policy, like in our yeshiva, that you have to wear a hat. So if you don't have a hat, you know, you have a problem in our yeshiva. He goes, but that's not halacha. You learn a lot from the questions also, that some will even have a question that you're going to give up tefillah b'tzibur because you don't have your hat. And then growing up, I remember I was in camp, and the counselors, of course, because they believed you have to wear a hat in davening, so they put on a baseball hat, an old baseball hat. And that's kavod, that's wearing a baseball hat. So, what can I say? Reuven, they don't make them like this anymore, I don't think. What do I want to show you? Oh, here. Here's the, this is the Rambam, Perek, Hilchos Mila, Perek Beis, Halacha Tes. So he says, the question is, let's say you don't have the instruments for the Bris Mila. Can you have a non-Jew bring it for you on Shabbos? All these questions. And he says as follows. The general principle governing this matter is it's permissible to tell a Gentile to perform any activity that we are forbidden to perform as a shvut. In other words, you can have the non-Jew do a rabbinic activity because we have to do the Bris Mila so that we may perform the mitzvah at its appropriate time. When, however, an activity is prohibited because of forbidden labor, that's a Torah violation, we can't ask a non-Jew to do it for us on Shabbos. You can't have the non-Jew go and, cut down the knife for Mila because it's a Torah violation. So we see for Torah violations, you're not allowed to ask a non-Jew to do it for you, even for a mitzvah. And what he says, if you look later in them, if you look in the Gemara, it's, of course, it's decided. We see that that when it comes to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, living in the land of Israel, you can buy a, the Rambam mentions this in Hilchos Shabbos, chapter 6, Halachot Aleph. You can purchase a house on Shabbos from a non-Jew. If you're purchasing it, you can ask a non-Jew to write the shtar on Shabbos, even though writing is Melacha D'oraisa, he says. Why can you? Because of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, the rabbis don't say that, you know, it's the rabbis who say that you can't ask a non-Jew to violate a Torah prohibition for you to perform a mitzvah. But because Eretz Yisrael was so important, they exempted that. So you could have a non-Jew do a malacha d'oraisa to enable you to acquire property in Eretz Yisrael. And what does he conclude from that? Mizem muchach, the mitzvah sishmer Eretz Yisrael, gedola mea mitzvah hayoter gedola shehi b'charis. In other words, so we see from here that living in Eretz Yisrael is even greater than bris milah. Bris milah, if you don't do it, you have kares. And yet we're not allowed to, if the knife, you can't have the knife unless the non-Jew makes it for you. You can't do it, and you'll have to do it on the ninth day, on Sunday. Even though this is a very important mitzvah with kares, excision for, whatever kares means, there's different understandings, but it's a very bad thing, kares. But when it comes to Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, we can. The rabbis do allow us to have a non-Jew violate a Torah prohibition. That shows you how important living in the land of Israel is. I don't understand how anyone now, you know, how you could challenge this. The people who say that living in Eretz Yisrael is not important. Even the Rambam, who doesn't count it as a positive commandment, a chiyuv on everyone, he records this as halacha, that you can have a non-Jew violate a Torah prohibition to acquire property in the land of Israel. It's a Gemara. It's in Gittin, I believe. So that's, he makes that point. And then in this letter, this is from 1886. This is before he goes to Eretz Yisrael. He's writing to one of these people who are not so enamored with returning to Eretz Yisrael. And this rabbi, his name is Rav Simcha Bick. He's Av Beis Din in Moav. That's really the city that somewhere back in time Rav Moav's family came from. This rabbi Bick, I wonder if it's related to the Bick family, Rav Moshe Bick, important rabbinic family, or rabbi in America. He came to America. He's from Mezhebuz, though. He was from Hasidic. He's a descendant of Yerushak of Emden, Rav Moshe Bick. I once davened with him on Shabbos when I was a kid, maybe only 10, 11 years old. We used to have Shabbatones. And that was like one of the only shuls in Borough Park to daven Nusach Ashkenaz. So we went to daven with him. But he, Rav Moshe Bick, was already an Eloy and a Musmach in Europe when he comes to America at age 16. And he's at the second smicha. He goes to Shiras Rav Yitzchak Elchanan and has smicha from Moshe Soloveitchik, but we don't have much in the way of him of tshuvos, halachic writings. But in the next issue of the Mashbir, you go to my academia page, you see I've started to publish now four, maybe already, from my collections of all the manuscripts I found. I'm publishing a tshuva. As far as I know, it's the only tshuva. It's the only tshuva I know from Moshe Bick on halacha. And so I was very happy that it was given to me by Rav Gershon Appel's grandson. Gershon Appel was a rabbi in Seattle, and he has grandchildren. Michael Appel, I thank you, Michael. I know sometimes you listen to the classes. Michael was very kind. Michael's daughter married the son of the rabbi in my town, Shul. So thank you, Michael, for providing me with that. I hope to publish it soon. It dealt with the mikvah controversy in Seattle. Mikvahs in America used to use the water from the, do you know this? From the pipes. They used to, just like you turn on the faucet, that's what they used to use. That was used in America, and that was the case out in Seattle, and that was how old the Rabbani, but you had that, that was standard in North Africa, that was standard in England. There was a good article by someone years ago in the journal Conversations talked about the change. It was a rabbi called the Helmetzer. He comes to America, and he really made a revolution on how we do mikvahs. It was, look, at the end of the day, it was a dispute. And it does seem that the majority opinion is against using, let's say, the regular reservoir water. But that was the minhag, and the Aruch HaShulchan discusses it, etc. Okay, so what is Rabbi Bick? He wrote to Ramoliver that he doesn't want an esrog from Eretz Yisrael. You know, well, today we all get the esrog from Eretz Yisrael, and when they started with the Yishuv, many big rabbis said that you have to only buy esrogim from Eretz Yisrael to support the new yeshuv. The Hasidim still like their esrogs from Greece or from Corfu, from Italy. I hear today that also many of them still, I know Chabad gets it, but one of you emailed me that lots of Hasidim get it from Italy. I know some get it from Morocco also. But why did this rabbi did not want to get from Eretz Yisrael and say they're going to support the non-Jews in Corfu and other places? He says because when he saw the esrogim that gave Eretz Yisrael, he saw that they had hashkacha on it, that truma was taken from the esrogim. And he says that this is wrong. Peros that come from Eretz Yisrael to Chutzar, it's paturim truma maizros. So that is, truma maizros taken. And he's saying, since these people giving the hashkacha, saying, you know, that truma maizros were taken, they obviously don't know halacha, because if they knew halacha, they would know that when you get the stuff from Eretz Yisrael, you don't need it if you're not living in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, that shows that they're not reliable, so I'm not going to rely on that hashkacha. And Rabbi Moliver says to him, you're absolutely wrong that this is a machokes. And in fact, today we assume that you do need to take it. I mean, that's if you look at the OU and all the others, okay, they all tell you that it's important to know. You can't just go buy a food from Eretz Yisrael. I mean, but all the ones that are exported, they do take trumos and maestros. But they say you have to, although Rav Avadia and his tshuva says you don't need to. He holds like the halacha that you don't need to be concerned with it. If it's produced in Israel for export, you don't need to worry about it. But Rav Moliver says this is a machokes, and plenty of gedolim hold that you do need to take trumos and maestros. So therefore, you're wrong in what you say. That so he rebukes him. And of course, Eretz Yisrael is very important. Now, the point I want to focus on now, and this is, it's, the whole letter is reprinted in this volume. It just came out this year. I was pleasantly surprised. It's Magid. Magid is a Corinth that you can actually buy this in America. I was worried that I wouldn't be able to get it in America, but all the Corinth Hebrew books, you can get them in America. And yesterday at the Tikva conference, Rabbi Yosef Pollack was there. He's like in charge of all the distribution, and they were selling the Corinth books. So it reprints the whole letter that Rav Moliver wrote when he comes back from Eretz Yisrael. Now, this first appears in, even before I get to that, let me introduce you to a book. Two volumes appeared of this book. Right at the time, it's called Shivat Zion, the Return to Eretz Yisrael, Return to Zion. First one is 1892, volume one, and then there's a volume two as well. What does this book have? This book has letters from all the Gedolim who were Litvish Gedolim mostly, but not only, in support of settlement to the land of Israel. What a great mitzvah it is, how important it is. So in, and there's stuff, of course, from Rav Moliver. Now in, I'll just call your attention in volume, two, this is not really totally relevant to us, but I found it fascinating. I just happened to come across it, so I think I'd share it with you. In volume two, page three, right at the beginning, which begins with letters from the Malbim and Yisrael Yeshua Trunk, and then the middle letter is a letter, Reuven Halevi, rabbi in Dunenburg. Dunenburg is also known as Dvinsk. I'm not going to try to pronounce the way it's in Latvian, how they pronounce it. You can look it up. But this rabbi, actually, Rav Kook, was there, gave a hesped on him. Rav Kook was quite close to him, even though Kook was young when he passed away. But he has a letter, of course, also supporting settlement in the land of Israel. And he says as follows. He says that looking at the difficulties that the Jews are suffering, the colonists in Eretz Yisrael, the ones who are Yoshi Malakarka, what does he say? L'dati maisa satanhu. He says that what you see going on in Israel, where it's so difficult to get these settlements going, he says that's the Maisa Satan, the Satan creating problems for us in order to stop settlement in the land of Israel. Why is this of interest to me? Because if you know the Satmar position from the beginning was, the whole state of Israel is a Maisa Satan. If you're asking, look at all the miracles, the creation of the state of Israel, Six-Day War, Yom Kippur, all these things, most people look at it and say, and Tebbi, all these say, well, this is, it's clearly God doing miracles for the Jewish people. The Satmar Rebbe says, no, this is the Satan. The Satan's doing miracles. I mean, this creates all sorts of theological problems. It's almost like a dualist system here. You have the good God, and then you have Satan, who, has the ability to, create all sorts of problems. But I guess there's sources, you know, Eov, you have the Satan there, but, Rav Kasher has a long discussion of the theology behind the Satmar Rebbe here, which, comes dangerously close to a dualistic, almost idolatrous, conception. But for the Satmar, everything that happens is, it's the Maisa Satan to create a test for us. So we see how successful Israel is, that they can blow up all these, you know, walkie-talkies and pagers, and they could do all the great things Israel's done from the beginning. And it's a test. The Satan is testing us to see whether we will conclude, which appears to be the case, that this is obviously God watching over the Jewish people. And only if you're able to resist that and understand that it can't be that, because God would never bring any miracles through the irreligious, so you will recognize it's from the Satan. So that's the whole Satmar theology, which is not shared by other anti-Zionists. The Satmar Rebbe, I mean, he has a separate type of anti-Zionism, like Ada Haridi in Israel. They have no problem going to the Kotel. It's not an issue. But for the Satmar, you can't go to the Kotel. You can't go to Hebron. So here you see Reuven of Dunenberg, Reuven Halevi, he uses the term Maisa Satan, but he's doing it just the opposite, that the fact that it's hard to settle Eretz Yisrael, that's the Maisa Satan. So quite interesting. Now, in volume one of the Sefer, Shivat Zion, which is, like I said, has all the great letters of the rabbis, you also have a long letter from Rav Moav. Actually, okay. So he has the letter. Now, what does this letter say? It's reprinted in chapter 12 of this book, and it begins as follows. And this is where you see clearly how his view is developed. It's the title is, and this is what he titled it: Matarat Nesiati L'Artzenu Hakadosha. The purpose of my journey to the Holy Land. And not only does he discuss what he saw there and why he went there, but he also presents a new theology of Eretz Yisrael. If you remember, Rav Moaver, of course, great supporter of the settlements, but he struggled with what to do with if they're really irreligious Jews there. At first, he seemed to be tilting that, you know, we don't want them there. We should get rid of them. But on the other hand, that could create all sorts of problems. So originally, he seemed to be on the Netziv side, and then he joined Rav Eliasberg's side, that we can't have them leave. But that's because they're already there. Once they're already there, but this doesn't mean, lechatchila, we're only going to send Jews over there who agreed to observe Torah and mitzvot. When he goes there, he changes his mind, and look at the theology that he comes up with. I can see why it's going to be problematic. But okay, so he begins his discussion, before he even gets to the practical things he saw there, with how great living in Eretz Yisrael is. And he cites the Gemara that says in Maseches Ketubot, Kesubos, L'olam yador adam b'Eretz Yisrael afil b'irsha, you know, you should live in Eretz Yisrael, even in a city that's mostly idol worshippers, Va'al Yadur, Bechutzlaretz, Afilo Be'irsha Rov Yisrael, rather than living, that is better to live in Eretz Yisrael in a city that majority of idolaters than to live in a city in Eretz Yisrael in Chutzlaretz where they're Jews. Why? Shekol Hadar Be'Eretz Yisrael Dome Kemi Sheyesho Eloa. Because anyone who lives in Eretz Yisrael, it's as if he has a god. It means he's religious. The Choladar b'chutzaretz doma k'mishein lo. Anyone who lives in chutzaretz, it's as if he has no god. And the Rambam do I have it here? No. The Rambam has a little different language. I forget now. It's in Hilchos Malachim. he said, the Rambam says, maybe I'll get to it, but it doesn't say Domek Mishayish Loa, he, a little different language there, but that's what the Gemara says. By the way, this word, Aleph Lamed Vav Hey, for our grammarians, it's the most mispronounced word in the Hebrew language. And sometimes you have Chazoni, because we have it in Hallel. And even you can hear it, because Malecha, Yam, everyone can hear it. And they'll scream it out, Eloha! Well, first, yeah, there's a negation it. But first of all, if you look under the Lamed, there's the Metek, so the accent is on the Lamed, so it has to be Elo. But this is what we call a furtive patach, or patach kanuva. Just like you don't say for Noah, you don't say Noha, you say Noach. It's the same thing with the hay when you have the patach under it. And it's the Masoretes actually say there's two ways you can pronounce it. Eloa or Eloa, either with a W sound. And also the word, how do you say like smell? It's not Recha, it's either Reach or Reach. But everyone gets that one right, but they don't get Aloha right for some reason. So I've had numerous occasions where I've told that to Chazanim, and uniformly they're very happy to be taught that, because it would be embarrassing, I think, if you're saying it, especially like in Hallel, another time saying it on Yom Noraim, you should at least know how to pronounce it. What does then he say about this? You live in Chutz Laaretz. It's better to live in Eretz Yisrael among idolaters than to live in Chutz Laaretz.
Isn't the word Dome ambiguous? Can't it mean it has the illusion that he...
No. It means it's as if. The word Dome is important because he quotes the Hafla here, or Pinchas Horowitz. He's not saying that if you live in Eretz Yisrael, you automatically have a religious, you have a God, and if you live in Chutz Laaretz, you don't have a God. He's saying it's Dome. It's as if. Because obviously, the Rambam is living in Chutz Laaretz. You can say the Rambam doesn't have that. So it's as if. So what is Ramoliver then? And he explains it here that what does it mean? That Malas Eretz Yisrael Gadol Kokach, that is living in Eretz Yisrael, the level is such. Shekol Hadarba Afil Ein Biyado Lo Torah V'lo Mitzvos. If you live in Eretz Yisrael and you don't have Torah and Mitzvos, Kvar Domek Kedishei Yisrael Allah. It says, nevertheless, you're irreligious, but because you're in Eretz Yisrael, it's as if you are religious, and anyone who lives in Chutz Laaretz, etc. So listen to this, what Ramoliver says. He says that, Rotz Lomar, he says, where should I start here? He says, the meaning of this is that everyone should live in Israel, even if the city is full of idolaters. And now this is Ramoliver commenting, Rotzel Lomar, even if you live there, you will throw off the yoke of Torah and Mitzvos. That's an extra step. In other words, I think most people understand it, that I'm a religious person. I'm going to go to Israel. I'm going to live in a city of idolaters. It's better for me to live in there among the idolaters than to live in Chutz Laaretz among Jews, but I'm still religious. You know, that's all it's saying, that me as a religious Jew living among the idolaters in Israel is better than being a religious Jew in Chutz Laaretz. Rav Moliver says no. He reads this as, what do they mean there? That by living there, you will become irreligious. And even though you're irreligious, nevertheless, you still, it's dome and like you still have God because you're an Eretz Yisrael. We discussed this in the past. I told you about the situation of the Jews in Jerba who don't want to go to Israel because they're afraid their kids will lose Judaism. Rabbi Kelman said that in Mosheva, and I told you about my son at Mosheva. Everyone's supposed to go in Aliyah. What do you do in a case like this? And Rabbi Kelman recalled saying, no, the Vnei Akiva perspective was that everyone should move to Israel. It doesn't matter what's going to happen. And Ramoliver says that if you're in Eretz Yisrael, even without Torah and Mitzvos, that you should do that even if you lose your Torah and Mitzvos. Of course, you shouldn't lose Torah and Mitzvos. He never says to, obviously. But even if it happens, it's still better than being Chutz Laaretz. And therefore, you shouldn't be afraid of this. And then he says, listen to this. And when it says, don't live in Chutz Laaretz, even in a city that's mostly Jewish, Rotzel Amar, V'al Yedei Zeh Yishmor Torah V'Mitzvos B'Shlemus. Because you can only, if you're in, you're living in a town, let's say in Israel, and there's no Jews around, you don't have a minyan, you don't have nothing, you're all by yourself, and you're not even, can't even observe, there's no kosher food, whatever it is, better live there than to go to Chutz Laaretz, where, as he says, you can observe the Torah in its entirety. And he cites a passage from Yalkut Shimoni, where Hashem says in Yalkut Shimoni, he's, as it were, after, he's saying, they quote something there that the Bnei Israel living in the land and, are going to become Tamei in there, become irreligious. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Halavai Yiyu Bnei Ami Be'eretz Yisrael. The HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, would that my children be in Eretz Yisrael, Afal Pi Shemetami Musa, even though they make it Tamei. That is, even though, they're irreligious, God wants you to live in Eretz Yisrael, which we're going to get to. What about the sources that speak about the Holy Land spitting out the people who are irreligious? But it still is not saying what Ramo Liver says. All this is saying is that we want the irreligious to live in the land of Israel, even though their sins make the land impure, rather than living in Chutz Laaretz, for all the reasons we can understand, because it's a holy land, and better to be a sinner in Israel, where at least you're in a Jewish environment, let's say, or you won't assimilate, etc. We can, speaking contemporaneously, but Rav Bolliver goes a step further. He understands when it says Olam Yidar Adam Eretz Yisrael, even in a city that's mostly idolaters, he's assuming what it means is that you will be influenced by the idolaters, and therefore, even if you're going to be influenced by the idolaters, and even if Chas V'Shalom leads you to give Torah Mitzvos, you still should move there. Now, if you know you're going to be influenced, if you know you're going to give Torah Mitzvos, I don't think he's saying you should move there then. I think what he's saying is that you should move there, even if it's a possibility it's going to happen, and once you're already there and you don't do it, you're in a better position. I mean, I could be wrong on this, but I don't see how even Rav Bolliver could say to someone, go to Eretz Yisrael and make a trade. You know, you're going to go to Eretz Yisrael and give up mitzvos, because no one can give up mitzvos. And he's the biggest believer, of course, in mitzvos. But, if you go there, this is in response, then you'll use this in response to all the people who say, well, you can become irreligious. So if you become irreligious, you're still in Eretz Yisrael. And he's going to explain you can become religious in Chutz Laaretz also. But this is like a jump. When you say, and when you say that if you live in Chutz Laaretz, even in a city that's all Israel, it means that you're going to observe Torah, and you live in Eretz Yisrael, it means that through living in Eretz Yisrael, you'll give up Torah. Wait till you see what someone responds to this. But that's how he begins, already a bit radical, I think. And then he moves on. He says, since we see how important Eretz Yisrael is, we have to reject. There's a famous Tosfos in, I forget, in Kesubos, where Tosfos cites Rabbeinu Chaim. I believe it's Rabbeinu Chaim. It's Rabbeinu Chaim, where Rabbeinu Chaim says that today there's no mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. Why not? He says, because there's all, in Eretz Yisrael, we have to do the mitzvahs of Tullius Varetz, the agricultural mitzvos, and today we can't do it. We can't be careful about it. Economically, we can't. It's very difficult. So we can't observe these. So since we can't observe these the way you're supposed to observe them, therefore there's no mitzvah to live in Israel. This understanding already assumes that the purpose of living in Eretz Yisrael is through the agricultural mitzvos. This is what we call a hechsher mitzvah. That's the whole reason. If you can't do the agricultural mitzvos, then there's no reason to live in Eretz Yisrael. Now, the Maharit of Yosef Trani from Eretz Yisrael, within Eretz Yisrael, he says that, that Reb Chaim never could have said this, that the, Talmud Torah, this is one of the early examples of where you say when you don't like what appears in an earlier source and you say he couldn't have said it. So it's a Talmud Torah. It's the, an erring student put this in. There's no reason to assume that an erring student put it in. Why can't, it makes perfect sense. If you assume that, the purpose of Eretz Yisrael is to mitzvah Tullius Baaretz, then there's no reason to go there if you can't observe the mitzvah Tullius Baaretz. The Maharit thinks it's a mitzvah in and of itself to live in Eretz Yisrael, a mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, he assumes that this is not correct. And Rav Bolliver says, Kimat Kol HaPoskim, most poskim agree with that, agree with the Ma'arit to reject this Reb Chaim, and that also in our day and age, it's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. So then he says, now that we see how important Eretz Yisrael is, we read the Yalkut Shimoni, we see that the Ma'arit, most poskim reject Rabbeinu Chaim. That is, most poskim assume that it's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. Even Ramosha Feinstein, who famously says it's not a mitzvah chiyuvis, says it's a mitzvah kiyuvis, that you fulfill a mitzvah, even though there's, we can't say it's an obligation for everyone to go to Aliyah, but by living there, you fulfill a mitzvah through the living there, quite apart from the mitzvah stress parts, which are a separate thing you do, and it's a zechus. So Ramogliver says, and again, this is before he even gets into what he saw in Eretz Yisrael, he's setting the stage. He says, I don't understand. Mama unifleite ha'alah. It's a wonder that there are certain gedolim. He says, Gedolei Amenu Hamufagim b'Torah v'Chassidus, pious Gedolim, she'hisnadu l'ikar yishuv Eretz Yisrael HaKodesh, l'idei k'nias sodes. And then vineyards, he says, it's shocking to me that we have rabbis, you know, first level rabbis, Gedolim, who oppose this whole idea of going to Eretz Yisrael and trying to settle Jewish farmers there. I mean, if you look at Shivat Zion, it's like a who's who of Gedolei Yisrael. But not all the Gedolim are there. And, you know, you look at there's Gedolim in Hungary, there's Hasidic Rebbe's who didn't sign it. So Ramogliver is saying, he doesn't understand it. And he says, and then he explains, so why did these rabbis oppose it? He says, because these new farmers, Uvifrat HaTzeirim, and especially the young ones, they don't observe the Torah. You see, they go to Israel and they stop observing the Torah. So Ramogliver says, even if this was true, I've already told you, Kfar Kasavnu, we already wrote that God prefers that his children live in the Holy Land, even if they don't observe the Torah properly, then they live in Chutz Haaretz and observe it. And then he says, even the person, Even the one who hates Eretz Yisrael the most of these people, they hate settlements in Eretz Yisrael, will not be able to say that these Jews who don't observe Torah in Eretz Yisrael are worse than they would have been if they were in Chutz Haaretz. I don't know. It's interesting empirically to see if that's the case. If the people, he's saying that the people who were irreligious were already irreligious in Russia and that they didn't become worse, when they went to Eretz Yisrael. I don't know if that's factually correct. It would be interesting. I mean, yes, a lot of them came to Eretz Yisrael as, in rebellion against traditional Judaism, but, by the time you get to the 1920s and 30s, there's no question that, who came with some sort of religiosity, the children left. That there's no doubt. But even in the first generation, I'm not so sure about that. But okay, look. So then he's going to continue with his defense. We can't continue now. I see it's already 9:29. But we're going to pick up right with this defense and wait till you hear which Hasidic Rebbe is going to take Rav Molliver to task for this statement. And then what do you do with the Yalkut Shimoni though? And next class we'll talk about practical halacha maisa. Many Gedolim dealt with this issue. Do we encourage irreligious Jews to go to the land of Israel or not? And you'll hear what Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank ruled about this. And so good stuff coming next week. Let me take the questions and comments here. Let's see. Thank you all for coming out tonight. So someone says that Rav Reuven Feinstein was not expressing actual approval of joining the IDF, but was guiding Haredi educators on how to respond to 12-year-old kids' expression of approval. I don't know. I heard he said that when you turn 18, if you're not going to be a yeshiva bachar, if you're not going to be learning Torah all day and you turn 18 and you want to go into the IDF, you go to the IDF and make you a mensch. Why is that so controversial? I mean, that used to be the standard view in the Haredi world, that only people who are learning Torah, Torah Mnoso, and only people learning Torah all day get the exemption. But everyone else has to go to the army. Now it's become a new thing in the last 10 years that just because you're a member of the Haredi Society, you should have an exemption. That was never the view. And you say in this that his take is that since they're only kids, you can deflect their interests, encourage enlistment, might be good for them. I don't know. Look, you can ask him. You can ask him what he meant. But all I can tell you is what he said on the tape, that what's the problem? If they want to, if they say one day they want to go, in the Haredi world, you're supposed to try to uproot that and say this is terrible, that's the worst thing, it's shmad. He's not saying it's shmad. He says, so fine, right now you have to learn. If you still want to go at 18, then you can go. By the way, you know that he has family who are in the IDF. I mean, the whole side, from our Tenor side, someone privately points out, I forgot about this, that the Rambam gives his original view, what he thinks that we count, how we count the Shemitah and the Yovel. And then he says, but since the Gaonim differ, we go like the Gaonim. And the Raiva on the spot says there that no, that you were right the first time, that, you shouldn't have abandoned your opinion. So this is the only example where the Raiva says that the Rambam is right when the Rambam says not to follow the Rambam. Yeah. And finally, someone privately says that, oh, I asked to find out what Rav Aaron Cutler's practice was, because in trying to understand how the yeshiva world started adopting the tzitzis out, Lake has been very important, and Rav Aaron Cutler was very much held to the Mishnah Brura. Maybe he's reason for it. So someone who from Lakewood tells me here that he asked a family member and he was informed that he wore them over his shirt. So that's not the same thing though, wearing over the shirt. Cause if you wear them over the shirt, then you do leave them out because then it's a problem. You wear them over the shirt, then you tucking them in, you're embarrassed. The question is, so what do you do so we still don't have an answer to this. You have to find out, what about for people who wear the tzitzis under the shirt? Did the Rav Aaron hold it should be outside or not? Shmuel says, who's Rav Reuven speaking? That's the Torah Masorah convention of 2 weeks ago. Mel says, you can do the bris on the ninth day, but if you don't buy the property on Shabbos, you might lose it altogether. Okay, I'm not sure what you mean. Now, that you can't do a Issur D'Oraisa. You can't have a non-Jew do an Issur D'Oraisa for Mila, or Rambam says. Chaim says, Rav Zvulun Harlap told me that if one wears a hat during davening, it must be a dress hat, which makes perfect sense. A hat is not a technical thing that there's a halacha. You have to have a second covering. So therefore, it doesn't matter. Or I could put this paper on it and I fulfill it. No, or put a second kippah on. That's not what it's about. It's about being, as Rav Reuven explains in the clip, it's about a kavodic way of acting. So to put on, like when I was young, the kids, the counselors, they put on this dirty baseball hat. The whole thing doesn't make any sense. So yes, it should be a dress hat or a nice hat. MJ Frankel, it's indeed difficult to pronounce, but just as difficult as Shnadim say Rakia. Listen, we can't do the Patach Ganuva with an ayin, really, because hardly any of us really pronounce the ayin. So we can't do the ayin. But Eloah, that's not difficult. Certainly you can say Eloha. You don't need to do that. Nikki says that your stepbrother had to climb out of the window at night from the near yeshiva to join the IDF for the six-day war. But you know, here those were yeshiva students full-time learning. In those days, there weren't that many yeshiva students. It's a very different situation we have here. You know, in the 48 war, there was lots of yeshiva students. But thank you for that. We spoke. If you remember, going back now, we're putting on the podcast my latest book, The 53 Classes. And in there, I spoke about Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, who was in the Irgun, or Lechi, I think it was. And he was in, where was he? Hebron, I think. I forget now. But you had a lot of people like that who felt that it was important. And I don't want to get too much into the politics here, but we'll see what develops. That's all I can say. Thank you all for coming out, Rabbi Kelman.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, J.J. Schechter told us that, he learned in the mirror. when right after the Six-Day War, I think, for a couple of years. And he was close to Rav Chaim Shmulevitz. And, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to say Halal on Yom Yerushalayim, because apparently there was a bomb that landed right near his house. I don't know the whole story, but he said Halal on Yom Yerushalayim. And J.J. Schechter told us how sad it was. I remember he told us that davening in the mirror, Yom Yerushalayim, Rav Chaim got up, they said Halal, and half the yeshiva walked out. And he found that was such a lack of cover.
Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was like a quasi-Zionist. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, famously, I heard this from one of my rebbes who was at the mirror, that the guys were up on the roof for while watching planes and things, and he ran up and started screaming at them, if you're not going to be in the basement, you should join the army. You're only having exemption because you're learning. And he has a drusha, which after 67, which is very, very Zionistic, which they don't like to publish, but you can get it. So Rav Chaim Shmulevitz was known to be very, like Rav Gustman. You have a whole, well, Rav Gustman. Do you know Rav Gustman on Memorial Day? Rav Gustman used to stand out and watch the parade with the soldiers. So they asked him, and this is not Art Scroll. This is a documented story. And they asked Rav Gustman, how could you do this? You know, it's not the SNEAS, the girl soldiers. And he said, I saw Jewish children killed. If I can see Jewish children, young people walking, you know, with pride like this, I'm going to do that. Then we know the other stories I told you, Rav Gustman and Rav Alman. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, you know, these people, they go on the Kfarim tours. I mean, they leave Israel all the time to go to Poland and Hungary and all these places. Hungary, I encourage everyone to go. It's the safest place in Europe now for Jews. I heard this yesterday at the Tikva conference, but I've been saying this for years. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach said, I don't understand why people are leaving Eretz Yisrael to go to Kfarim of Kedoshim. You can go to Har Herzl. And there's anyone who's killed defending the Jewish people as a status of a kadosh. So we have a lot of these old style Lithuanian gedolim who I don't think they'd be accepted today for some of their views. So let's just leave it at that. Yeah. Okay.
Well, unfortunately, but yes, we can leave it at that. Okay. Everybody be well. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman continues his shiur on Yoshua, all our regular shiurim this week. Parsha this week, Rabbi Liebtag is going to be giving the Parsha shiur live from Alon Shvut at 3:30 a.m. Israeli time, but that's what he wants to do. So that's fine. We look forward to learning with you, and everybody be well, and let's hear good news, and let's hope that, the total change, the new Middle East, you know, not unfortunately, let's hope the new Middle East comes, the Shimon Peres new Middle East, not the crazy new Middle East we have today, but who knows what will be, but it's really unbelievable. And let's hope for good news. Okay, everybody, be well, and Laila Tov.
Toda Rabba, Laila Tov.
Laila Tov, Toda Rabba.
Bakasha.